Good morning. It's the 20th of June, a Saturday, and the light has been coming up slow and warm over the desk while I've been reading. Saturdays, I like to take the long way in, so before I get to the four pieces that landed overnight, let me walk back across the whole week with you and trace the shape it made. Grab your coffee and settle in. There's a real thread running through these days, and I think it's worth pulling. If I had to name this week in a single line, it was the week the frontier kept colliding with its own limits, some imposed from outside and some baked into the technology itself. The story that ran like a spine through the whole week started the previous Friday and never really let go. The United States government ordering Anthropic to pull its two most capable models, Fable 5 and Mythos 5. On Monday, the order itself was the headline. The models switched off, and not only for customers abroad but for Anthropic's own non-American staff. By Tuesday, the fallout had its own gravity, with cybersecurity researchers organizing, an open letter circulating, and the security community split over whether the move protected anyone. By Wednesday, the pushback had grown into a coordinated call from industry and academia, asking the administration to let the models back out. I'll come back to this in the first segment, because the overnight reporting finally lays out the mechanism behind it, the specific export control lever that was pulled. But hold on to the shape of it. Release, restriction, and a week of argument about whether the restriction made any sense. Around that spine, the week's second thread was raw capability in the sciences, and it was genuinely striking. On Thursday, OpenAI and Molecule.1 described a near-autonomous artificial chemist that designs, runs, and improves its own synthetic roots with barely a human in the loop. On Friday came a result I keep turning over. OpenAI's O3 Deep Research turned loose on 376 unsolved rare disease cases, surfaced 18 new candidate diagnoses. Whatever you think the ceiling is, this was a week where these systems stopped being demos and started looking like collaborators, in a lab and in a clinic. The third thread was quieter, and to me the most interesting, a recurring note of sobriety, running underneath the capability stories. Call it the gap between the impressive surface and the missing substance. On Friday, one group showed that sparse autoencoder interventions, the interpretability technique everyone leans on to steer a model by clamping a feature, are unreliable. That clamping a so-called unsafe feature can quietly hide a behavior rather than remove it. The same day, a benchmark called WR Bench made the case that today's world models render gorgeous frames but lack any persistent internal state, that the world stops evolving the moment the camera looks away. That thread runs straight into this morning, by the way. One of the overnight papers picks up the persistent state critique almost exactly where Friday left it. There was money in movement, too, the way there always is. DeepSeek closed a record round north of $7 billion at a valuation above $50 billion. SpaceX agreed to acquire the coding company Cursor for $60 billion in stock. Noam Shazir left Google for OpenAI. And Z.AI shipped GLM 5.2, an open mixture of experts model that immediately ranked among the best for front-end coding. A reminder that the open weight frontier did not slow down just because the closed one was having a hard week. On the hardware side, NVIDIA's Blackwell swept the ML perf training benchmarks, which matters for the efficiency thread I'll pick up later this morning. And defense autonomy kept its steady drumbeat, with Shield AI and Destinus demonstrating autonomous strike and teaming early in the week, and the Air Force awarding its first operational collaborative combat aircraft production lot on Thursday. So that was the week, a frontier pressing outward in the lab and the clinic, pressing against a government willing to pull the most powerful models off the table, and underneath all of it, a growing honesty about how much of the impressive surface still rests on foundations we've not actually built yet. Now with that arc in mind, here are the four things I came across overnight, and they pick up those threads, almost one for one. First up, and it's the piece that closes the week's biggest story. As the previous week ended, the United States Commerce Department sent Anthropic a letter invoking an export control directive, and the lever it pulled is unusual enough to be worth saying slowly. The directive barred non-Americans, including Anthropic's own non-American employees, from accessing Claude Fable 5 and Claude Mythos 5, the two most capable models the company had ever shipped. Anthropic had introduced Fable 5 as a new tier it called Mythos Class, with capabilities it said exceeded anything it had previously made generally available, and Mythos itself was tuned for cybersecurity work, finding software vulnerabilities on both the defensive and the offensive side. Within about a day, access was switched off for the affected users. What set it in motion was a report from Amazon. Amazon researchers contacted officials to share findings that they could jailbreak Mythos and pull out portions of its vulnerability-finding behavior in ways the government judged a national security risk. According to the reporting, Anthropic was warned that Fable 5 had been jailbroken and declined to pull or patch it before the directive landed. Anthropic, for its part, has characterized that specific jailbreak as not serious and has pointed out that the same classes of jailbreaks exist in competing frontier models, which complicates the idea that pulling these two models actually closes the capability off. The security community's reaction was split and worth hearing in full. A group of cybersecurity researchers signed an open letter calling the removal dangerous, their argument being that taking a strong defensive tool away from legitimate defenders does more harm than the risk it removes. At least one security executive said the response looked out of proportion to what the underlying research report actually contained, noting that the researchers had surfaced vulnerabilities by asking the model exactly the kinds of questions a normal defender would ask, which is precisely what the model was built to do. There is also reporting that a foreign group had already accessed the model before the controls took effect, which raises a hard question about how much was actually contained. Here is why I would hand you this one. It is one of the first times a United States frontier model has been pulled from distribution by direct government action under export control authority, rather than held back voluntarily by the lab. It folds a company's own safety disclosures, a competitor's red team report, and a national security judgment into a single enforcement action. And it stretches export control tools, long aimed at chips and fabrication equipment, onto model weights and API access. One last wrinkle the reporting could not resist. The ban seems to have made the two models far more famous than they were before it. Moving on to the second story, and it's a swing at one of the oldest walls in the field. A Miami startup called SubQuadratic, which came out of stealth in early May with $29 million in seed funding and an outsized claim, has started publishing evidence for that claim. The company says its model, SubQ, is the first frontier-scale language model that abandons quadratic attention entirely in favor of an architecture whose compute and memory grow close to linearly with the length of the context. The mechanism they describe is called subquadratic sparse attention, content-dependent routing, that computes exact attention only over the tokens it judges relevant to a given query instead of over the entire sequence. That is where the asymptotic savings come from. The numbers are aggressive. SubQ ships with a usable context window of 12 million tokens. The company claims it runs dramatically faster than a flash attention baseline at the 1 million token mark, on the order of tens of times faster, with reports of more than 50 times, while costing roughly a fifth of what comparable frontier services charge for similar long context work. The pitch is that this opens up tasks that are awkward today. Reading hundreds of documents or an entire code base in a single pass while using far less energy per query. And critically, SubQuadratic claims SubQ more or less matches the quality of the leading lab's models on standard tasks. That last claim is the one that matters, and the one that has drawn the most fire. When the company first appeared, the details were thin and a lot of researchers were unconvinced, and with reason. The history of subquadratic and linear attention architectures that looked wonderful at small scale and then quietly failed to hold quality at the frontier is a long and crowded one. What changed this week is that SubQuadratic released results from an independent evaluation, and those results were strong enough that some people who had dismissed the first announcement said, it might be worth a second look. The honest framing is that this is a step, not a verdict. Throughput and cost are the easy things to verify. The hard part, faithful retrieval and reasoning across 12 million tokens, without the quality cliffs that sank the earlier efficient attention schemes, is the part that has to survive outside scrutiny when independent researchers get their hands on the weights or the API. But this is the most concrete reason in a long while to think the quadratic attention bottleneck might actually be breakable at scale. Third up and staying on efficiency, but going one level deeper, down into the arithmetic that the largest training runs are now built on. A new paper on the archive takes aim at 4-bit floating point pre-training. 4-bit training, FP4 as it is usually written, promises big cuts in memory and compute, and the hardware that matters, NVIDIA's Blackwell and the coming Rubin generation, along with AMD's MI350 series, is all organized around a particular 4-bit format called E2M1. This paper argues there is a flaw baked into that choice. The representable values in a format like E2M1 are not evenly spaced. Their spacing is geometrically asymmetric, and the authors show that this asymmetry produces a systematic, one-directional rounding error, which they call shrinkage bias. The word systematic is the important one. This is not random noise that averages out over a training run. It is a consistent pull in one direction that accumulates multiplicatively as it passes through layer after layer. And here is the part I found genuinely surprising. The bias is amplified by the random Hadamard transform, the very technique labs apply to tame outliers and make 4-bit training stable in the first place. The tool deployed to fix low precision training is, in this specific way, making one of its errors worse. Having traced the problem to its geometric origin and shown how it distorts training dynamics, the authors propose a corrected recipe they call UFP4, which removes or compensates for the shrinkage so that 4-bit pre-training tracks higher precision baselines much more faithfully. What I like about this one is that it is mechanistic rather than a patch. It does not just observe that 4-bit runs drift, it explains why, predicts where the drift comes from, and offers a fix grounded in that explanation. For anyone planning a large pre-training run on current 4-bit hardware, that is not an abstraction. It is a directly actionable change to the recipe. And it lands right in the middle of the efficiency thread I flagged earlier in the week, when Blackwell swept the training benchmarks. The hardware is racing ahead on low precision, and the numerics underneath it are still being worked out in public, one paper at a time. And for the fourth and final story this morning, something more reflective, an essay that reframes the whole trajectory we have been talking about. Dwarkesh Patel published a piece arguing that most of the progress of the last few years has come from widening and improving the data distribution and pouring compute into generating better data, not from making models meaningfully more sample efficient. And if you define intelligence partly as sample efficiency, how little data a system needs to become fluent in a domain, then it is not at all obvious that the field has improved much on that axis. The systems got better mostly because the data got better, and because there was enough compute to manufacture that data in the first place. The clearest case he develops is reinforcement learning, and let me spell that out. On first mention, reinforcement learning from verifiable rewards. In this framing, it is really a synthetic data engine. You spend compute against a verifier to find the good rollouts, then train the model to imitate those correct trajectories, much the way next token prediction trains it to imitate text. But there is a catch, a bootstrapping constraint. For the search to work at all, the model has to already assign some non-trivial probability to stumbling onto a correct answer. If it essentially never succeeds, there is no positive signal for the verifier to amplify and nothing to learn from. Which means reinforcement learning is powerful for sharpening capabilities the base model can already occasionally express, and weak at instilling genuinely new ones from scratch. The reason this matters is that it relocates the bottleneck. If progress has been riding on better data and compute-intensive data generation rather than on better learning algorithms, then the field is more exposed to data limits than the smooth scaling story suggests, and the harder, much less glamorous problem of real sample efficiency is sitting there, largely untouched. It is an argument, not a benchmark, and it comes from one of the more influential voices in the conversation. Its value is in naming the load-bearing assumption that a lot of the optimism quietly rests on, and after a week spent watching these systems hit walls, some external and some internal, it is a fitting note to end on. So what was this week actually about? Pull the four pieces together and the answer is limits, the places where the frontier meets something it cannot simply scale past, a government reaching for export control authority to switch off the most capable models in distribution, an attention mechanism whose cost has bounded long context work for a decade, now maybe cracking, the arithmetic underneath four-bit training quietly biased in one direction, and the quiet suspicion that the data, not the algorithm, has been doing most of the work all along. Capability and constraint moving together. The full digest has all 33 items if you want to go deeper on any one of them. That is all from me this morning. Sunday is dark, so I'll see you Monday. Until then, keep reading papers.